from 90.9 WBUR, I'm Deborah Becker. This is Radio Boston. Coming up with a powerful nor'easter just behind us and another one just ahead, we look at questions being asked about Massachusetts' preparedness for climate change.
It's getting worse and worse. I mean, this is the three highest tides in recorded history have happened this year. It's only March.
Also, researchers say diabetes is on the rise, and there could be five types of the disease that require specialized individual treatment. Also, Arlington's police chief joins us to talk about law enforcement's increasing role in dealing with mental health issues. Plus, Dartmouth College students go to prison to write a play with inmates and learn lessons about privilege and the criminal justice system.
This person just made a mistake, but they're doing something with their lives. You know, this person just works at Burger King, so they're not really doing anything with their life. Who cares what happens to them?
That's all coming up next on Radio Boston.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Deborah Becker. While coastal Massachusetts is still cleaning up from the weekend nor'easter, another storm is on the way. Forecasters say it's still too early to predict, but it appears that much of the state could get 8 to 12 inches of snow on Wednesday from a storm that should begin after the morning commute and continue into Thursday. State and municipal officials are still assessing the damage after the weekend storm that prompted Governor Charlie Baker to declare a state of emergency. A Civil Air Patrol flyover to assess damage that was scheduled today has been postponed. Thousands of households are still without power, and outages are reported from the Berkshires to Boston and to the Cape and Islands. Joining us with an update is Chris Bessie. He's a spokesperson for the Massachusetts Emergency Management Agency. Welcome to Radio Boston, Chris.
Good afternoon. Thanks for having me.
So I understand you just got off a conference call with municipalities across Massachusetts about this storm. What are you hearing?
That's right. So it was a kind of a multi-part call. Part of it was to gain information from them about concerns or issues that they have. We didn't have anything significant from the call, but throughout the day today, we've been working with them on various requests that they need, working to get various heavy equipment out to them, certain types of pumps to some communities, certain communications restoration issues that they may be having. So working through some of those issues and also providing some guidance on debris clearance and an eye towards the next storm.
So the main concern seems to be debris clearance, would you say?
Well, the power outage is the big concern at the moment, and you know, we're working closely here with the utilities. Although MEMA doesn't have a role in that, we do the coordination if there's power outage for critical infrastructure. So power outage is the biggest concern, but in terms of the requests and the stuff they're looking for from MEMA, it's a lot of the equipment that they may need during the recovery process.
Where do the outages stand right now?
So as of 3 o'clock, there's about 53,000 customers without power, still a majority in the southeast part of the state, particularly Plymouth County and in Barnstable County out on the Cape.
And when do you think you might have an estimate or a tally on how much damage was done by this storm?
So we're now going through a process with other state agencies to go out and do some initial rapid damage assessments, just trying to get a sense on rough buildings and infrastructure. And that's not necessarily tied to a dollar amount, but just a rough sense of how bad things are and where they are. So there's teams out in the field today, and we'll continue to be out tomorrow. We're getting an aerial flyover of some areas tomorrow. So we'll get more information in the coming days and as communities report information into us.
So you think you should know this week, have a rough idea, at least in terms of structures that were damaged and what you're dealing with here? And then
At least from the communities we've been out to, we should have some of that. And then that will help us as we go forward and look to see what different disaster assistance programs might be available.
Because the governor declared a state of emergency on Saturday. And so you would need this information to proceed, correct?
That's correct, yep.
What about for those evacuated? When can they expect to return home?
So it really depends on the local conditions and the damage of their homes. For many people, if they had to leave due to high tide and it was just water and the water has subsided and gone back out, they're probably either already back in their homes or very close to that. If people are in an area that evacuated and there's, you know, the roads are impassable due to debris or other infrastructure damage, they'll need to check with their local officials and determine when those roads may reopen. And then there may also be homes that, you know, suffered enough damage that they may not be able to return to their homes. We've seen some, you know, pictures of homes in, I know, Sandwich and Quincy and some other areas had some pretty significant damage to homes that may be impacted as well.
You said 53,000 without power. When do you think all the power will be restored?
The information that we get from both the major utilities involved, Eversource and National Grid, is that they believe by tomorrow evening that they'll be back on essentially all of their customers.
And how about preparations for the storm, the new storm that we're supposed to get on Wednesday? Are you tired, Chris?
We keep an eye forward as well. So we just get actually another update now coming in from the National Weather Service on potential impacts. This also looks like more of a snowstorm than this past storm that we saw from much of the state. But we are expecting some strong winds as well. Not quite as strong as this past storm, but with heavy wet snow and winds, there could be additional power outages possible as part of this upcoming storm.
All right. Chris Bessie, spokesperson for the Massachusetts Emergency Management Agency. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thanks for having me. Stay safe.
The weekend nor'easter was the second time this winter that Massachusetts was hit by a so-called 100-year storm, which brought strong winds, heavy rains, and astronomical high tides that flooded coastal neighborhoods and knocked down trees and power lines throughout the state. And the volatile weather has left many people wondering if this is the new normal. Here's Governor Charlie Baker reacting to the storm damage while touring Quincy yesterday.
A lot of the coastal stuff is probably going to be part of our future, and we need to come up with some plans for that.
But what steps can be taken in the short term to prepare? Well, to help answer that, we're joined in studio by Greg Altmaus. He's executive director of the Better Future Project, a volunteer-led statewide climate action network. Welcome to Radio Boston.
Thank you for having me, Deborah.
Also, Julie Wormser. She's an independent climate resilience consultant with North Cambridge Consulting. Thanks for being with us.
Nice to see you.
So we want to ask you listeners as well, were you affected by the nor'easter this weekend? And what do you think the city of Boston, your community, or the state should be doing to prepare for storms like this? You can call us at 800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. You can also send us a tweet at Radio Boston. So I'd like to start with you, Greg. What can the city or the state do in the short term, do you think, to help prepare, better prepare, presumably, for these types of weather events?
Yes, it's a great question. I think we need to celebrate that there has been some really strong leadership from both the city and the state to prepare. And, you know, a lot of that has been around planning, which is more of a long-term process and scoping out the vulnerability of our communities. Governor Patrick's administration has created a big batch of funding for different communities to apply for so they can do their own vulnerability assessments. But I think really in the short term, there are kind of both short-term infrastructure improvements we can make and short-term social improvements we can make. On the social side, it's really about connectivity and really identifying who are the vulnerable people in our community and are they aware of the government services that are available to them in the case of an extreme weather event? Do they know where there are shelters they can go to, and do they have people who are going to check in on them or transport them to those shelters to make sure that the most vulnerable are looked after as these disasters come? And on the infrastructure side, again, there are some bigger, longer-term projects we're talking about. But there's also just, when you think about flooding particularly, you think about how much surfaces, you know, in urban areas, it tends to be a lot of paved areas. And there are ways that we can really change the nature of that. When water falls on pavement, it just sits there or it goes somewhere else. But it does not go into the ground. It goes in someone's basement or it goes into the sewage system and backs up the water systems.
Right. So a lot of people look at the Seaport District, for example, and they say, ay, 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 look at all that development, right? Are we not doing what you're suggesting here in terms of infrastructure improvements? Julie, you're pointing. Do you want to answer this question? Are we not doing what we need to be doing in terms of infrastructure improvements when you look at that level of development?
So here's the challenge. A lot of the both the infrastructure and the buildings on the Seaport were permitted before the Great Recession. And nobody, including the nonprofits, including the academics, were thinking a whole lot about sea level rise, particularly this quickly. Hmm. So a lot of that that was in process before Superstorm Sandy. Post-Superstorm Sandy, the city's been doing what it can. The challenge, though, is that our building codes are controlled by the state. And so the city doesn't have either the control over its revenues or the control over its building codes in order to make the city more resilient. And that's really hampering not just Boston, but any Massachusetts community.
Mm-hmm. And what do you say about this, Craig? I mean, what do you say in terms of the development that's going on and you know, folks raising concerns? So if the state is the one responsible here for permitting and making rules, I mean, do we need to change those, the state permitting process? I mean, what do we need to do?
Yeah, so there is a lot that the state can do. There's a great act right now called an Act for a Cleaner Energy Future, which involves both looking at a comprehensive adaptation management plan for the state, creating some funding to go along with that, as well as a lot on the mitigation side. But I think it is worth noting that, you know, that from one report I read suggested there's been $18 billion in public incentives to build in the Seaport area. Mm. You know, most recently, Mass Mutual just is announced that they're looking to build a new facility. WBR just reported on that. And they've got $46 million in government incentives to build there. And I think it's really worth questioning, do we really want to be actively encouraging building, providing public funding to build in places that we know are going to be flooding?
Hmm. You know, we did speak with the Greater Boston Chamber of Commerce, and we asked them, you know, what should businesses be doing? What should developers be doing about this kind of thing? At some point, won't their developments need new flood zone areas, new, you know, all kinds of new work? And let's listen to a little clip here from Jim Rooney. He's president and CEO of the Greater Boston Chamber of Commerce.
I'm a big believer that for some of these major environmental or other issues, social issues, that the business community should not expect government to be the provider of all solutions and answers at the city, state, or even federal level.
Julie Wormser, I'm wondering, what do businesses do? What should they be doing because of the threats of climate change?
Well, businesses with a long-term incentive are already doing the right thing. So, for example, Spalding Rehab or Atlantic Wharf or Clippership Wharf, these are business owners with a model of staying put for a long time. And somebody like a hospital has zero tolerance for patient risk, right? So things like making themselves floodproof, not building right on the water, but leaving a transition zone that could be flooded without harm, elevating their mechanicals, using materials that aren't harmed by salt water. There's a range of things that are very creative and also very beautiful that people are doing. The challenge is when developers don't have regulations that create a market signal. Developers with short-term business plans have a disincentive to invest more than they have to in floodproofing. Hmm. And so, in fact, they're not. So you have a range, even though the city is doing what it can with something called a climate resilience checklist, it's still voluntary, it's still open to negotiation, because again, they don't have the right to require things like elevating everything above a future flood zone.
I want to make sure we get some listeners in here in the conversation. Just reminding listeners that you can call us. Were you affected by the storm? What are your thoughts about whether the state or your community or the city of Boston, any of them prepared for climate change? And do these storms signal that this is the new normal? Our number here is 800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. You can also tweet us at Radio Boston. Elizabeth is calling from Brighton. Elizabeth, you're on the air.
Hello. Thank you very much for having me on. I would like to ask a question to Dr. Wormsley, if that's the correct title.
Julie Wormser.
Pardon?
Julie Wormser.
Oh, Julie Wormser. I'm sorry. Mm-hmm. Is there any thought, I guess this is a citywide, any thought among cities, either cities or consultants, to consult the Dutch engineers who have recently been providing or planning for a 10,000-year flood, knowing that, A, that's no longer the time, that's no longer an accurate characterization. It probably, you know, the intervals can be shorter. And, B, they might know, they might have things for us to do, having had centuries of experience with this problem.
Hmm. Okay. Elizabeth, thanks so much for the call. Julie, have we ever thought about what the Dutch have done in their preparations?
Yeah. No, you're right on track with that. I mean, if anybody knows flooding, it's the Dutch. That said, their 10,000-year flood is our 500-year flood because their weather is a lot tamer than ours. But nonetheless, they have come to Boston multiple times since Superstorm Sandy. They worked very closely with folks in New Orleans and after Sandy in New York. And so for the Dutch, really an export industry is flood technology, and we've been benefiting from their knowledge and their technology. They say three things. Basically, first, you need a barrier, whether that's a barrier across the harbor mouth, which they don't suggest because it's hard on the ecology, or a seawall. You can't have water sloshing in and out of the city on a daily basis, as will happen once the seas get a little higher. Mm. When that fails, and it will, you need a transition zone. That could be a salt marsh, that could be a playing field, that could be a plaza where water can go in and out without harm. When that fails as the sea continues to rise, and it will, you need to be able to batten down the hatches of your infrastructure and your buildings so that the salt water, which is very corrosive, won't enter the buildings. And when that fails, and it will, you need to move either uphill or upstairs. And so they've given us a real understanding of how we can protect ourselves in a way that also makes the city more beautiful.
What other cities are doing it well?
Boston's actually one of the few cities that's trying to do it well before having had a major disaster, including the Dutch. They had crazy flooding in the 50s that killed over 1,000 people. New Orleans, New York, Copenhagen, Rotterdam, Amsterdam, these are all very thoughtful folks. Some of the things that are in common is there's a great sense of community. The non-American cities, they have more centralized planning and governance than we do. It's harder in the U.S. to do that. But a lot of what they have in common is saying it's too expensive to do single-purpose flood control. Let's also make it beautiful. Let's also solve other urban challenges.
So is there one proposal that you've seen in another city that you say, I wish Boston could do this here, or you'd be prepared to really push for here because you think it would be successful?
If I could adopt Copenhagen's cloudburst plan, I would.
What is that?
So the idea of a cloudburst is these really intense rainfalls that we're having. And that actually is part of climate challenges that's going to hit even faster than sea level rise. It's already hitting, where we get very, very intense rain in a very short amount of time and it overwhelms our storm system. What they've done is done beautiful parks that are engineered to absorb a lot of water. They are decreasing their carbon emissions by doing fantastic bike paths that are elevated so they don't flood. So they're basically looking at every part of the city and saying, how can we absorb water? How can we store water? How can we add more greenery? So it's becoming a cooler and cooler place to live as they're decreasing their climate risks.
I just want to, we have someone on the line right now that I want to make sure we bring into the conversation. This is Austin Blackman. He's Chief of Environment, Energy, and Open Space for the City of Boston. Hello, Austin. Are you with us?
I am. Thanks so much for having me.
So Boston has what's known as a Climate Ready Boston plan. Can you just briefly explain one or two initiatives in that plan that might help in terms of future storm resiliency?
Sure. So the whole purpose of that plan was to really accomplish two things at a high level. One, understand where Boston is vulnerable to climate change, and then two, come up with conceptual ways, or in other words, shovel-ready projects that we could adopt to help mitigate some of those vulnerabilities. So we've completed that vulnerability assessment, and now we're going neighborhood by neighborhood, particularly to the most vulnerable areas of Boston, and developing these shovel-ready projects to protect those neighborhoods from the impacts of climate change. We've completed East Boston and Charlestown, and we're in the process right now of doing a similar study for South Boston, which actually has the ability to protect areas all the way through the Back Bay and other parts of the city as well.
You know, there was an article in the Washington Post that was published last night, and Emily Norton with the Massachusetts chapter of the Sierra Club and a city councilor in Newton compared Boston and state officials to people with emphysema who keep smoking. She says they need to be hit with a 2x4 to take action now to help in the short term. What's your response to that?
Well, I think that we've been working on these issues for quite some time. And if you look at other cities across the globe in terms of those who have a permanent staff working on climate adaptation, who've done a climate action plan, who've updated it multiple times, who've dedicated capital in their capital budget to protecting their cities from these risks in advance of a storm, Boston's really on its own or amongst a very handful of cities who have taken that many steps. Is there a lot more work to do? Absolutely. And that's the reason why we've done these studies, to really understand what those vulnerabilities are, but then also to make sure that we're making the wisest investments in terms of the places that are going to be impacted first.
Is there, when folks say things like that to you, though, Austin, I mean, is there a concrete proposal? Because a lot of the folks have said there's a lot of talk about this right now, but there's not a lot of action. Is there a concrete step that's been taken or piece of action that you point to and say, we are doing this to prepare?
The short answer is yes. As I mentioned, we've come up with those shovel-ready projects, and we've actually announced that we're going to be moving forward with implementation on $2 million worth of them as well, both to protect an area of Charlestown close to the Sullivan Square, and then also in East Boston on the East Boston Greenway, which is one of the very first flood entry pathways that allows water not only to go through the Greenway, but then actually shuttle past several other neighborhoods of East Boston as well.
All right. Austin Blackman, who is Chief of Environment, Energy, and Open Space for the City of Boston. Thanks for calling in today, Austin.
My pleasure.
Greg, I want to ask you, what do you say to folks who say, what can they do to take it upon themselves to try to prepare?
Yeah, so, you know, there's a lot, again, that you need to do. One is just to create an emergency evacuation plan, an emergency communication plan with your family to figure out where you're going to meet in the event that your cell phones don't work. There's a lot you can do in terms of getting your basement prepared. You think, go into your basement, look if there's a couple of feet of water, what's going to be hit? Are there family keepsakes down there? Are there electrical outlets or appliances or utilities that should be moved and elevated? But also, again, I think getting involved and pushing government to take more action, both to prepare for climate change and to prevent, because a lot of what's coming is preventable if we really take the time to stop building new infrastructure, stop building new fossil fuel infrastructure, and reduce emissions.
I want to try to get one more caller in before we run out of time. Joe is calling from Dorchester. Joe, you're on the air.
Yeah, hi. I think it's interesting that people are talking about we got to stop rebuilding more infrastructure and whatever and focus on what we've got. The seaport is going to be underwater in 25 years, and they won't stop building there, and it floods all the time. I'm in Dorchester right now in gridlock traffic on Dorchester Ave because Morrissey Boulevard is flooding. So what is the government of this state doing about it? Because I've had it.
All right, Joe, thanks so much for the call. Either of you want to take Joe's question here? He says Morrissey Boulevard is flooded. He thinks the seaport's going to be underwater in 25 years. What is the government doing about it?
I mean, I think the short answer is not enough, Joe. I think that you're right. And, you know, I think, unfortunately, there's a lot of comparing how we're doing to other cities and other states. And, unfortunately, Mother Nature does not grade on a curve. It's not good enough to say we're doing better than other places. We really need to be thinking, who is vulnerable here? What can we do now? Both, again, to prevent this from happening, because scientists have been warning about this for decades, and we did not take their warning seriously, as well as taking much more concrete steps to take action in the immediate term.
Julie, last word.
Yeah, our state government is set up to go slowly and be centralized, and that's exactly not what we don't need for climate change adaptation. Cities and towns need to be able to raise money locally. They need to be able to act locally to do things like elevate Morrissey Boulevard or protect themselves. And the way our budget and policy works, it's really hard to do that. So it's going to need actually statewide leadership to give more power to towns to defend themselves.
All right. Julie Wormser, an independent climate resilience consultant with North Cambridge Consulting. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
Also, Greg Altimos is executive director of the Better Future Project, a volunteer-led statewide climate action network. Thank you.
Thank you.
Stay with us. There's more ahead. I'm Deborah Becker. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Deborah Becker. Some recent tragedies now making headlines are raising questions about how to determine if someone is dangerous. From the school shooting in Parkland, Florida, to the fatal stabbing in the Winchester Public Library here in Massachusetts, people are coming forward saying that there were warning signs of impending danger, but no one really knew what to do. Some say better training of police officers could help. The Arlington Police Department was recently chosen as one of only a handful of law enforcement mental health learning sites in the United States. Joining us to talk about this is Arlington Police Chief Frederick Ryan. Hi, Chief.
Hi, Deborah.
So what does this selection of a law enforcement mental health learning site mean for Arlington?
Right. Well, we implemented our program around 2010, where we have a co-responding licensed clinician that responds in the field with police officers dealing with people in mental health crisis or substance use disorder crisis. And we've made a lot of mistakes since 2010, and we've learned a lot from implementing the program. So the Council on State Government and the Bureau of Justice Assistance has selected Arlington and a handful of others nationwide to help other law enforcement agencies implement similar programming.
So you'll basically train others how to do that program that you started in 2010, where you have a clinician go out and help police officers understand mental health issues. So it's not necessarily growing the program you already have. It's just taking it elsewhere.
Taking it elsewhere and serving as a model for other law enforcement agencies in the country.
You know, in the two examples we gave, and I asked you this, Chief, not to talk about those specific police departments, but to talk about the role police officers have in something like this. In Parkland, Florida, where we hear that people were calling the police with warnings about the gentleman, the school shooter in Parkland, and then, of course, the recent stabbing in Winchester, where we read that neighbors were calling police because they were concerned about that young man. Police are increasingly becoming the face of the folks who have to deal with mental health issues. So how do you deal with that as a department?
Yeah. Well, you know, when we implemented our program, we looked at the data, and a minimum of 10% of our calls for service had a mental health element to them. And many of them had sort of co-occurring disorders, both mental health and substance disorder. And you know, we recognize that if all we give our police officers is handcuffs, that's all they'll use. Mm. And so we implemented a co-responding clinician who literally responds in the field with police officers to calls involving mental health. Now, before our program, you know, a cop dealing with somebody in crisis had no other choice but to arrest them for some low-level crime to restore order. And, you know, he or she thought they were doing their job. That's sort of what the policy of the department was. And so we've really turned that on its head, and our arrests have gone down, and so has our crime rate. But, you know, now we're diverting people into the healthcare environment or, you know, we're connecting with their mental health providers once the situation is stabilized and you know, this whole notion of being tough on crime, right? That's easy. Criminalize everything, arrest everybody, and warehouse them in jails. That's simple work. Being smart on crime is difficult work, and that's what we're trying to do here. Is, you know, some of these low-level criminal acts that occur in every community in the Commonwealth, likely many of them have a mental health element to them. Yeah. So can we be dealing with these situations more proactively, more effectively, and having a positive impact on the quality of life in our communities?
Is it difficult, though, and where do you draw the line? Because you do have to keep order, right? And you do have to say there are consequences. So is there a guiding principle here that you say to yourself, well, this is where we have to draw the line?
Yeah, you know, it's funny. That's a timely question. You know, I serve as a co-chair of the Police Assisted Addiction Recovery Initiative, PARI, which is a national organization trying to change the conversation from arrest and incarceration around substance use disorders to one of prevention and education. But I still have to do my job as a police officer. And just this afternoon, as I was getting ready to come in for this interview, I witnessed a man nearly drive through the window of a Dunkin' Donuts in Arlington. And I approached him and conducted an investigation. And he was impaired by the consumption of opiates.
Really?
And in that instant, we arrested him. I mean, so you're right. There are certain situations where arrest and prosecution is the proper public policy and the proper response. But when we're dealing with crimes that don't compromise public safety, just, you know, low-end users supplying their habit, we've got to be smarter about the way we provide police services.
You know, the White House held an opioid summit just last week, and this follows the Opioid Task Force. Governor Baker is a member of the White House Opioid Task Force, and the Trump administration has said it's taking several steps to deal with the epidemic, such as opening up more addiction treatment, the rules about who can go to treatment and things like that. Do you feel that there's enough action on the federal level?
I was happy that the administration declared it a public health state of emergency. I think that was long overdue. I do wish that additional resources were made available, particularly to those hardest hit areas of the country, West Virginia, Ohio. I have a lot of colleagues. You know, if this were some other public health epidemic, right, we'd be stockpiling the antidote that saves lives at every street corner, right? There are law enforcement agencies who have trouble getting the resources to buy nasal naloxone, and that's because of the stigma associated with addiction. And I think the stigma goes right to the highest levels of government, and that we need to be bringing a true sense of urgency to this issue and providing the resources that go with that sense of urgency.
Are we putting, though, too much burden on our criminal justice system because of our failing mental health system?
Well, short answer, yes, but I'm proud of, particularly in Massachusetts, the way that our municipal police chiefs have stepped up and taken on this responsibility. We sort of collectively rolled up our sleeves and said, we're not going to sit around and wait for the bodies to continue to turn up. We're going to exercise some leadership and reverse this trend in the Commonwealth. The Baker administration have been great partners with municipal police chiefs. And we're making a difference, and we're being recognized as national models.
I want to ask you just briefly about two proposals that fall into this category. One is safe injection sites, whether we should consider safe injection sites where people could use drugs under medical supervision to save lives. Good idea or not?
Well, you know, keep in mind that safe injection sites allow immunity for those using drugs in a safe injection site. That's basically all it does. And it's interesting that whenever the conversation about safe injection sites comes up, people, you know, the stigma kicks in. But I ask the question like this. Under the current state of the law, if somebody is using in a private home and they access 911 because somebody has become sick from an overdose or an unsterile needle, they're immune from prosecution.
Well, I mean, now we have fentanyl laws, and so that may throw a wrench into some of that, right?
It could, but follow the logic. Mm-hmm. So we allow and we grant immunity in an unsafe, unhealthy, unsterile environment. Yet when we move to have the conversation, now I'm not saying I've made up my mind about safe injection sites, but when we move to have the conversation about safe injection sites, people jump up and down. So why would we not at least discuss granting immunity in a safe, sterile, healthy environment when we allow it in an unsafe, unhealthy, unsterile environment? Hmm.
So that logic appeals to you.
It does. Mm.
Second, just briefly, because we're just about out of time, in terms of red flag legislation that we're talking about right now and guns after the Parkland shooting, and that would allow police to take away the guns of someone who's determined to be dangerous. Good idea or not?
Absolutely.
Good idea.
No question.
Okay. Frederick Ryan, Chief of Police in Arlington, Massachusetts, thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you.
Gary. Diabetes is very much on the rise. More than 100 million Americans have diabetes or pre-diabetes, according to the Centers for Disease Control. If current trends continue, the CDC estimates that 1 in 3 Americans could have diabetes by 2050. Well, we're used to thinking about diabetes as being two types, but now researchers are suggesting that maybe diabetes should be divided into 5 different types. To explain, we're joined, as we are most Mondays, by Carrie Goldberg, who's host of WBUR's Common Health. Hi, Carrie.
Hey, Deb.
So 5 types of diabetes.
Yes. So this is research done mainly in Sweden on more than 14,000 patients over age 18. And it's just out in a journal called The Lancet Diabetes and Endocrinology. And actually, what caught my eye was a headline in The Guardian newspaper about it. And it said, 5 categories for adult diabetes, not just type 1 and type 2, study shows. And I had the same reaction, like, what? 5 types? But what it's mainly about is dividing type 2 diabetes, which is by far the more common one, into clusters of patients. So one group might have mild diabetes that's mainly related to age. One might be a mild type mainly related to obesity. And then there are 2 severe types, almost more like type 1.
Well, let's just remind folks of type 1 and type 2 to begin with.
Okay, so here are the basics. So diabetes is a condition where you have high levels of glucose in your blood. So lots of people call it the sugar, right? Remember, my aunt used to say my uncle had the sugar. And it's because your body can't properly process and use sugar. It can't properly turn the food that you eat into energy. And diabetes can cause a lot of serious complications. It's the 7th leading cause of death in the United States. And it's basically a problem of insulin. So insulin is the hormone that you need to help get the glucose from your food into your cells. And in type 1 diabetes, your own immune system mistakenly destroys the cells in your pancreas, the beta cells that make insulin. So you have to get insulin by injecting it because your body isn't making it anymore at all. And type 1 tends to occur in children and young adults, but it can definitely occur in older people too.
And type 2?
And type 2 is the vast majority of cases. It's something like 90%. And it means your body doesn't make enough insulin or it doesn't use insulin well. Type 2 is linked to obesity and inactivity, among other things, and it can respond to lifestyle changes and pills, unlike type 1, but it can also reach the point that you have to inject insulin.
So why is this actually more complicated by splitting it into maybe 5 types?
Right, like why isn't 1 and 2 enough, right? And so, you know, it might not make sense for the general public because plenty of us have trouble remembering the difference between 1 and 2 as it is, unless we're affected by diabetes somehow. But this new study suggests that the 5 categories could be really helpful for doctors because it could help guide the treatments that they recommend. So I spoke with Dr. C. Ronald Kahn. He's the chief academic officer at the Joslin Diabetes Center here in Boston. And he says, first of all, this study is a good reminder that diabetes includes a real mixture of types, even within the classification of type 2 diabetes.
It does impact on how you think about treating diabetes in different groups of people, and whether you think you can get by with only diet or diet and exercise or maybe a simple oral medication, or whether you realize that the person is going to need more heavy-duty type of medication, injectable medications.
And injectable medications would be either insulin itself or medication that stimulates insulin.
But don't doctors do this already?
Yes. So, I mean, Dr. Kahn says, yes, to some extent, they decide how to treat patients based on their type of diabetes. But he says many doctors who treat patients with diabetes don't measure all the dimensions that were looked at in this study. So this Swedish study looked at some easy and common elements like age of diagnosis, body mass index, that's how much you weigh, basically, hemoglobin A1C, that's a measure of how well your diabetes is controlled. But the study also looked at 3 things that are not so routine, like antibodies that are linked to the autoimmune kind of diabetes, and a couple of other measures of insulin. One is a hormone called C-peptide. And Dr. Kahn says he's a fan of those extra measurements because they do help you know what to expect. And he hopes maybe this Swedish article could help change clinical practice here in the U.S.
In some ways, we sometimes focus on being so cost-effective that we eliminate tests that are useful, but you can't necessarily prove that they're quite as cost-effective. For example, the C-peptide measurement. In their study, they showed that it does help predict who's going to need different levels of treatment, and if you know that in advance, then you can be ahead of the game instead of playing catch-up ball later.
So, Carrie, what exactly are the 5 types of diabetes that this suggests?
So in very rough terms, and this is all in adults, you've still got type 1 diabetes, which is the autoimmune form. Then within type 2, you've got 2 severe forms of diabetes. One actually looks a lot like type 1. It's pretty early onset. You're not particularly overweight, but it doesn't have those antibodies that are signs of the autoimmune diabetes. And then there's one that's a severe form of insulin resistance diabetes that is linked to obesity.
And then 2 more mild forms. forms.
Right. One mild form that's more linked to obesity and one mild form that's more linked to age, to being older. So basically, this research was looking at clusters, and it suggests that the treatments could be tailored better as we gain more understanding of the subtypes.
All right. Carrie Goldberg, host of WBUR's Common Health blog. You can find a link to the Lancet paper and the Guardian article at our website, radioboston.org. Carrie, thanks for being with us.
You're welcome.
Stay with us. There's more ahead. I'm Deborah Becker, and this is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Deborah Becker. Powerful questions about privilege, poverty, and prison are being raised in a new documentary film that's based in New Hampshire. The film, titled It's Criminal, chronicles a Dartmouth College class that brings together students and women behind bars at the Sullivan County Department of Corrections in Unity, New Hampshire. Over the 10-week class, students and inmates write a play together, and the film focuses on the relationships that develop while they're doing that. Here is a scene involving one of the incarcerated women by the name of Malika, who's describing meeting one of the Dartmouth students for the first time.
I hated her. I absolutely hated her from the minute I saw her. She's like what you think the Dartmouth girl is going to look like. She's beautiful. She's blonde. She has pretty teeth. She had her beautiful pearl earrings. And I felt like, how dare she wear those here?
The documentary screens free as part of the Globe Docs series at the Coolidge Corner Theater in Brookline tonight. Joining us in the studio to talk about this is Signa Taylor. She's director of It's Criminal. Hi, Signa.
Hello.
Also with us is Charlotte Gunderson. She's one of the women featured in the film. She was incarcerated at Sullivan County Department of Corrections, and she now works as an industrial supervisor at a home improvement plant and lives in Newport, New Hampshire. Right, Charlotte?
Yes. Hello.
Well, thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
So, Signa, let's start with you. Your film centers on this Dartmouth class, as we said, that was organized by Professors Ivy Schweitzer and Patty Hernandez. And we have a clip here of Ivy asking some really profound questions. I just want to play this before we get to you. And she says she was inspired when Angela Davis spoke at Dartmouth and urged the audience to incorporate issues of incarceration into their teaching. And here's Ivy on one of the big questions that she asked the Dartmouth students to reckon with heading into the prison for this class.
I think one of the ultimate questions we have to ask ourselves in terms of this class and what we're going to be doing at the facility is, what group are we in? Are we the oppressors or are we the oppressed?
Signa, tell us a little bit about this class and the big questions to the students and the women who were incarcerated about the big questions that it presented for them.
Sure. I think Ivy and Patty put together a very powerful experience, both for the incarcerated women and for the students. And they're both, like the clip that you just played of Ivy Schweitzer asking, are we the oppressors or are we the oppressed, comes from Paulo Freire. And so there's a theoretical background that the students and the women receive, and then they put that theory into practice. And so a lot of times they're asking questions both on a really large level and then also a very personal level. And I think that one of the biggest questions that everybody faces in that class is really examining what privilege means and then also really examining what personal responsibility means.
Why did you decide to make a film about the process of making the play rather than a film that was the play itself?
Well,
what was it about this process that intrigued you?
Patty and Ivy create a platform where they bring very different groups of people who have very different amounts of power societally. They bring them together and they create almost this utopia where everybody's equal and everybody's voice matters. And so I loved the way that they approached this class, the process of bringing people together. So that was, you know, one reason. But another reason was the first time I filmed the final performance of the class, I had a very profound experience where I saw a woman who I assume was a Dartmouth student who is my age, who looked a lot like me and discovered she was a filmmaker. And I'd, you know, watched her perform in the play. And then when she got to the end of the play, she revealed that she was, in fact, a prisoner. And when that happened, she said that what made her most sad was the length of her sentence. She was 40 years old, and her sentence was 7 years. And what made her most sad was that she would never have biological children. Mm-hmm. And so I had this pang inside me after she spoke and I finished filming the performance, and I went back to my car and I just sort of sat there and cried, because I had that sense that she could have been me and I could have been her, that we could have swapped places in a heartbeat. Mm-hmm. And after that, I just kept filming the final performances. But then I wanted to know, like, how do you get there? Like, how do you get the experience of these incarcerated women and these students crying and hugging and saying this is the most meaningful experience they've ever had? Like, what does it take to get you there? And
Right. Charlotte, why did you want to get involved in the class, first of all, and then the film?
Right. So the class... you know, when Patty came to our unit, she has this character. She's like an enigma almost. And she truly makes you believe that you are special, and that you have a voice and that it should be heard. And it shouldn't matter how, you know, what your background is. And for me, that was mind-blowing, eye-opening. You know, I never really thought that anyone would care about my story, myself, my past, my voice, or any of that. So, you know, it was a great experience to learn a little bit about myself. And honestly, the filming kind of went hand in hand. You know, to participate in the class, we all knew it was going to be filmed. Yeah. But, you know, after a little while, you get used to the cameras, and you're so in tune with what's happening, and you're so engrossed in the moment with the students, and everything becomes so natural. You almost seem to forget that the cameras are even there.
At the beginning, when this first started, we heard a cut from Malika at the beginning, saying, "I can't believe that student wore those pearl earrings in here. I hated her the minute I saw her." I mean, how do you get over that, right? Because there's got to be some natural resentment, not just because they're Dartmouth students, but they're free right now and visiting you, right? And they have freedom and they have all of those things.
Absolutely. I think a lot of us, you know, assumed that they all came from these rich families that never had to work for, you know, anything. They had a free ride to Dartmouth. But the more that we got to know them and the more genuine they were, you know, with us, as we were being genuine with them, it kind of helped them to open up a little bit with us. And we all kind of realized that we had a lot more in common than we ever thought we would.
Hmm. You know what I noticed in the film, Signe, that the students were warned not to be open in the beginning of this process, right? They were told, no, you've got to watch out for these people that you're going to encounter behind the walls and all of that. And then there was a very powerful scene in the movie when the students do decide to open up. And some of the women who are incarcerated say they're frustrated. They feel like they're an experiment here, and they're just being watched, and it's sort of this visceral experience on the part of the students, but not a true meeting of people. So I wonder, how did you get around that? And was that something that played into your decision-making to turn the process into a film as well? You know what I mean? That there's you're watching these relationships develop from an I hate you for wearing pearl earrings and don't be open to all of a sudden there's some common ground there.
I think that was one of the turning points in the class. I think any time that you bring different groups together, create performance, you know, creative process is fraught a lot of times. Mm. And I think that was one of the turning points in the class that you mentioned, where the women said, wait a minute, why are the skits about us? Why aren't the skits like half about us and half about you? Because this whole class is about equality, right?
Right.
And so then Patty answered that, saying that it's about giving voice to people who might not have voice on the outside. And then the students, I thought Thander, one of the students, very, very beautifully stepped up to the plate. And she said, you know what? The reason that we're not sharing our stories with you is because it's really hard to be vulnerable. And then she started talking about how she felt vulnerable, that she couldn't get, in classes, people are getting A's. She doesn't even know how to get a B, that her father was experiencing depression and she didn't know how to handle any of this. Yet on the Dartmouth campus, you are meant to be perfect. You are meant to show up and smile and get A's and do 1,000 extracurricular activities. And so Thander just laid herself open and made herself vulnerable. And what I loved was Malika's response to her at that moment was, wow, who's to say whose pain is greater?
Right. Charlotte, you said that participating in this class changed your life.
Yes.
How come?
Yes. So when I was first incarcerated, I was an opioid addict. I also had no real self-worth or self-value. Kind of had been taught that from a little bit of a young age. And then, this class really helped me to understand that I do have some self-worth. My life matters. My thoughts matter. My story matters. And not only my story, but my story is countless of other women's stories. So I think if I hadn't been able to take this class and really open myself up and reflect on myself, I probably would not have done so well in the next part of the programming, which isn't in the film, but there's a lengthy trails program at the county facility of programming and rehab. And I don't think I would have felt like I was worth rehab or felt like I was worth saving if I hadn't taken the Telling My Story class.
All right. Charlotte Gunderson, one of the women featured in the film It's Criminal. Charlotte, thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
Also, Signe Taylor is the director of the film. Thank you.
Thank you.
It's Criminal screens free tonight at the Coolidge Corner Theater in Brookline. This is Radio Boston.